Thank you for your presence this morning, your interest in our study of the 21st chapter of the book of Acts. In this chapter, the Apostle Paul is arrested, and as you know, this begins somewhat of a climactic approach to his imprisonment in Rome that the book of Acts closes with, chapter 28, and conclusion of what happens to him there. Luke just leaves us suspended. We have to depend upon the prison epistles and the intermittent epistles between the Roman imprisonments to determine what happened to Paul as a result of this arrest here in the city of Jerusalem. There's a lot that I want to talk with you about in our study this morning as it pertains to the recommendation of the elders of the church in Jerusalem to Paul and his response to that, and some things I think that have even present-day applications, and we won't be talking about all of them, but we will make note of some of that as we go along. All right, Acts chapter 21. Is an interesting chapter in terms of application. I want to pick up the thoughts in verse 17 of this text. We know that the apostle comes to Jerusalem, it tells us in verse 17, and the brethren received us gladly. The day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. And when he had saluted them, he rehearsed one by one the things which God had wrought among the Gentiles through his ministry. And they, when they heard it, glorified God. And they said unto him, Thou seest, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of them that have believed. And they are all zealous for the law. And they have been informed concerning thee, that thou teachest all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the customs. What is it, therefore? They will certainly hear that thou art come. Now that sets the stage. We've talked about those verses, I know, but it sets the stage to be a very glorious occasion. And Paul comes to this city and tells them of his activities among the Gentiles. Now, that's something that we've studied before. We've studied that in Acts chapter 15, where the Apostle Paul and Barnabas have come to the city of Jerusalem, the same place we're talking about here, because there has been a disturbance from teachers who have come from among the brethren in Jerusalem, come to Antioch, and teaching those Gentiles who have become Christians that unless you receive circumcision after the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Now that's Acts 15, and I ask you to go back and look at the comparisons between Acts 15 and Acts 21. There are many, and we want to look at some of those as our study progresses today. But we note that in the rehearsal of Acts chapter 15, of Paul and Barnabas, of the mighty works and wonders that God had wrought through them among the Gentiles, there was occasion to rejoice and glorify God. Now, you would like to think that, at least on the surface, that here are some, at least as was the case in Acts 15, who were leaders in the church from Jewish background, who understand the profoundness of Gentiles and their obedience to the gospel, that understand the Old Testament prophecies of Joel and Isaiah that the nations would become a part of the kingdom of Christ. But the problem is that though that is the understanding predominantly among the leadership, Jewish background in the church, you don't have that understanding to characterize all of those who are of Jewish background who are members of the church. And that's unfortunate. And that has presented problems in Acts 15. It presents problems here in the church in Jerusalem. And we want to note that. You'll note further that in this text, these elders, and along with James, which indicates that he too is one of the elders, some have taken the position, however, that James and all the elders were present, that James in this instance was not an elder, that it was some other James. I don't necessarily concur with that, but be that as it may, we've got the leadership of the church in Jerusalem. They have occasion to rejoice because of the work that's been done among the Gentiles, but they acknowledge that there is a problem that exists in the church now in Jerusalem. Now, this is not just any meeting day of the church in the city of Jerusalem. Why is Paul there? This is not just any meeting day of the brethren coming together in the church in Jerusalem. Why has Paul come? Why is he there on this occasion? This is a very special day.
To deliver the gifts from all the other churches.
Well, that's true. And what we've got is Paul's hastened to be in this city to observe the feast day, in particular Pentecost. We know that's why he's hurried along to get there. Now, what was the common practice of Jews all over the world? That's right. Travel to Jerusalem to be there for the observance of the Passover and Pentecost. Now, these were Jewish feast days that we're introduced to, at least as far as the New Testament is concerned, the church and that sort of thing, as early as Acts 2, when that day of Pentecost was fully come, we've got people gathered together from all over the known world. And that presents the audience for Acts chapter 2. Now, that's essentially what we've got here, a repeat of that kind of enthusiasm of Jews all over everywhere coming to the city of Jerusalem for these feast days. Now, you'll notice in verse 20, it says, "And they, when they heard it, glorified God and said unto him, Thou seest, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of them that have believed, and they are all zealous for the law." I think it would probably be an error to conclude that all of these thousands that are identified by that term reside in the city of Jerusalem. These are likely Jews who have come from everywhere. And many of these, when you consider Paul's travels, this being the conclusion of the third preaching tour, these are likely Jews that have, includes Jews rather, that have become Christians from all over the known world. Now, one of the things that we want to notice here is just because somebody has become a Christian from a Jewish background does not mean that some of the feast days and so forth that were peculiar to their culture, that they've abandoned all of them. They have no more reason to come to the city of Jerusalem. That would be a far reach to come to that conclusion. And that presents the problem here. The fact that they are adherents of some of these customs is the problem. Do we see that? That's the background of the things that these elders are concerned about. Now look, if you will, at the text. At verse 20, there's an expression that we don't want to miss. And that is, of them that have believed. Who are these Jews that become the source of this issue? Christians. That's right. Now, I ask you to go back and make some comparisons to Acts 15. Go back to that now, if you would, to Acts chapter 15 and pick up the reading beginning in verse 2. Acts 15, verse 2. It says, "And when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and questioning with them, the brethren appointed that Paul and Barnabas and certain other of them should go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question." Now the question is introduced in verse 1. "Except you be circumcised after the custom of Moses, ye cannot be saved." Now we've got an issue. Verse 3. "They therefore, being brought on their way through by the church, passed through both Phoenicia and Samaria, declaring the conversion of the Gentiles, and they caused great joy unto all the brethren." Now, are brethren getting it that the gospel's for everybody? Yes. In verse 4, "And when they were come to Jerusalem, they were received of the church," much like what we read in Acts chapter 21. They were received of the brethren. "And the apostles and the elders, and they all rehearsed the things that God had done with them." Now look at verse 5 carefully. "But there rose up certain of the sect of the Pharisees who believed, saying, It is needful to circumcise them and to charge them to keep the law of Moses." Now, do we have a problem among believers of Jewish background? Yes, a major issue. A major issue. Now, I think, and we've discussed this in classes gone by, I think sometimes our thoughts are, and I know this because of my own personal experience, my own thoughts were in this vein a long time ago, and that is when we talk about Judaizing teachers, We're thinking of the Jews that wear the robes and the phylacteries and all of that, and they're just beating up on people that are becoming Christians. And that's not the case. We're talking about Jews who have become Christians. Jews who have become Christians. And you would like to think that Jews who have become Christians would be more familiar with some of the Old Testament prophecies, such as Isaiah 2, that folks from every nation will flow into it, that the word would flow from Jerusalem. Passages like Joel that Peter quotes in Acts 2, that whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. You think these passages would be outstanding, memorable passages in the mind of the Jew now who has become a Christian? Wouldn't you like to think that? Peter's statement in Acts 2 that the promises unto you and your children to all that are afar off, that this is all now clear by now. We've got years that have passed. But no, it's not all clear yet. And so we've got Jews who have become Christians who still have a problem with the Gentile.
Can you think of any scriptural basis upon which these individuals, and by scriptural basis now, we're talking about Old Testament, upon which they can appeal? And I think that one that they could use as you look at prophecies, you quoted what Joel said, anyone who calls upon the Lord will be saved. Great. They don't have any dispute with that. Gentiles, they can be saved. They just have to observe the law of Moses. And I think one of their arguments they would point to is perhaps Hosea chapter 2, where God is saying, I'm going to bring Israel back. And there are other Old Testament passages to go along with that. I'm going to bring Israel back, and here's how it's going to be under that, when I return, bring them back in. Now, they're incorrect, but I think that what we need to do is to try and make this more relatable to us, to where these are individuals that don't fully understand the scriptures and they're being biased by their upbringing, and they're not able to fully grasp the truth that's in the scriptures.
Though that's
Jeremiah
true.
That said, I'm going to have a new covenant. Well, new covenant suggests the old one's terminated.
Though that's true, and we have to acknowledge that the Jews did not understand many of their own prophets' testimony. They didn't understand those things. And some of those prophecies that you're speaking of, Hosea and some others, yes, found fulfillment in the kingdom, but also found fulfillment in their restoration period of Old Testament history. And so, yes, you've got a misunderstanding. But not just, I don't believe, on the part of those who were perhaps familiar with the law during that era when it lived, during the days of Isaiah and Jeremiah and some of those characters, but even in the mind of the Apostle Peter who quoted it. Apostle Peter who's quoting it in Acts 2. And he's making application of it, of all things, in Acts 2, verse 39. And upon that premise, the Apostle Peter went and preached to the Gentile household of Cornelius, and he took convincing to go there. And then in the 11th chapter, he's defending the conversion of the Gentiles on the premise of what God had told him, and then what James said that Amos in prophecy had said. So now we've got consistent application. Boom, boom, boom. Acts 2, Acts 10, Acts 11. But then, lo and behold, Acts 15, here we've got this issue. And then right on the heels of that, we've got the Apostle Peter acting inconsistently. And I think the thing that we want to see here is, if it was difficult for the Apostle Peter to wrap his mind completely around that and act consistently with truths not only that he knew, but he himself had made known, then for the general populace, we can see some difficulties wrapping their head around that.
And I don't want to be misunderstood here as trying to justify these Judaizing teachers. The bottom line is they had difficulty with really having a good love for the truth.
That's true.
And in the end, They were not able to step back and look at the Old Testament in total. They were still, I think, focusing on various passages. Plus, their natural, we'll say, bias or upbringing that trained them to think in.
There are several elements that are playing at the same time here. You've got this natural bias because they've been separated from the Gentiles for so long. But you've got a period of about 1,500 years that this has all been a family religion. And then during that 1,500 years, you've got such a divergent divide between the practices. Virgil and I were talking about that this week, between the Jews and the Gentiles. At this point in the New Testament, we've got Jews believing there is one God. From the standpoint of a Jew, you've got morally upright people. Now, I grant their hypocrisy and all of that, but their morals are intact and that sort of thing. But when you look at then the Gentile world, you've got people that have been used to observing the worship of plurality of gods. And as we see in Romans 1, the attitude that prompted idolatry to begin with was, I want to do as I please. And so you've got all kinds of the basest forms of immorality that were practiced on behalf of the Gentiles, while at the same time claiming to be religious in worship to these idol gods. And you see that depicted in Virgil, as we were talking, from Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 17 and on into chapter 5. And just a host of passages such as that, the Galatian letter and so forth. So you've got these divergent practices that exist between these two groups of people. So there's a lot of explanations of possible reasons why this prejudice exists. But the bottom line is, it exists. How do we resolve it in the church? How do we do that?
Yes, we will see this, well, within the church and we'll say outside the church. I mean, for instance, some of us have tried to discuss perhaps with other Christians about the work of the church or about authority. And it's the same problems there, that there's just not the love for truth.
Well, that's the bottom line.
And so we deal with that today, whether we're talking about that or maybe talking to some other that you saw, someone part of their denomination. It's just a difficulty we deal with today.
That's true. That is the bottom line, a love for the truth. However, prejudices, they're so divergent. There's so many things that affect that. But to wrap our minds around that in the church is the point that I want to emphasize here. And that's not new. We saw it in Acts chapter 15. We saw it as early as Acts chapter 11 with the Apostle Peter, his association with the household of Cornelius. And so it's not new. It exists today just as real as it exists then. The reasons may be different, but the problem is the same. Now, how do we fix it?
Right, and you may have somebody within the church that is trying to teach something that is error, and they're hanging it on some scripture that they may be misapplying or misunderstanding.
Well, that's true. And, of course, we're going to talk about that when somebody is blatantly teaching something that is erroneous. What do we do? But that's not necessarily the issue here. Yes, they were teaching that unless you receive circumcision, you can't be saved. That is blatant error. But it extends beyond that in this context. Is it possible for somebody to believe something that is a matter of their culture, a matter of their practice for generation upon generation, that does not involve the practice of error? That I might need to look at that a little bit more long-suffering. Now, let's ponder that, because I think that's key to understanding some of these things here. Randy?
First point, when he says, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews who have believed, they're all zealous for the law. That seems to be the problem, is that they're zealous for the law and not zealous for the gospel.
Well, that's true. They're zealous for the law, and they're hung up, if you'll note in verse 21, their accusations, they're hung up on their relationship to Moses. They're hung up on some of these customs and so forth.
So what that made me think of was over in Romans 10, when Paul is talking about the Jews at the beginning, and he says, my heart's desired prayer for them is for their salvation. For I testify about them that they have a zeal for God, but not in accordance with knowledge. They're not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own. They did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God.
All right, one point of difference between the text of Romans 10 and Acts 21. In the text of Romans 10, Paul is talking about his Jewish kinsmen according to the flesh, those who are not Christians. In Acts 21, the problem is with those who are Christians. Now, those in Romans chapter 10, they sought to establish their own righteousness. In other words, I am going to be justified. I'm going to be deemed right by keeping the law of Moses. All right? No, you can't do that. You can't do that. Because the only way that you can be deemed righteous is by obedience to the gospel. Romans 1, 16 and 17. You see.
So in Romans 10, Paul's talking about Jews who will not believe.
That is correct. And in Acts 21, he's talking about Jews who do believe, but those Jews who are hanging on to some of their Jewish customs. And what do we do with that? What do we do with that?
I'm not agreeing with your definition of the word custom.
Okay.
These customs that you're speaking about are tenets of the law of Moses. That is religious law. Now, realize that the one that they're talking about here is not a requirement. This is something that Jews may do if they want to. In other words, if they want to take a vow, they can take a vow. And therefore, it is not a requirement of the law, and certainly nobody is teaching that it's necessary for salvation.
All right.
However, the fact of the matter is that the word custom is used in the New Testament to indicate required tenets of the law. For example, in Luke, the second chapter, in verse 27, it says, and when he came in the spirit into the temple, and when the parents brought in the child Jesus that they might do concerning him after the custom of the law, we realize that there was the circumcision that came before that, and that this is presenting him in the temple. All of these things are requirements of the law. It was mentioned last week that circumcision is not a requirement of the law. It most assuredly is.
It became.
Yes.
But it did not begin that way.
No, and Jesus says that.
Okay.
It did not begin there, but he says that he may be justified according to the law of Moses, he circumcised the children. So we understand that Jesus said that the law of Moses includes circumcision, even though it's not one of the Ten Commandments and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
It's part
right.
of the law, but yes, Jesus says it was given to Abraham.
That is correct. Yes.
And, so
it did not begin with the law, but it was incorporated into it, in which
right.
we see that evidently being practiced by Moses when he brought the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt.
Exactly. And he made sure that they were all circumcised just after they went over
yes.
The Jordan River.
That's correct.
So the thing we need to understand, though, is that just because these people have done this for thousands of years, doesn't make it a custom, as we're talking about custom in the English language, which means that it's just a popular thing to do.
No.
These customs that are being talked about are tenets of the law of Moses.
It couldn't be anything else, Richard, from the standpoint of who we're talking about.
Right.
We're talking about these people who, that was their rule of law, as it were.
Yes.
The law of Moses. Now, question. Could there be some things involved in that? Like you mentioned, the vows and so forth. These were not required. These were some things that were done voluntarily. Could those things were certainly not a part of their practice unto salvation.
No.
But they were part of their customs.
They were legislated by the law as to, if someone took a vow, this is what you needed to do.
That's right. That's right. So that's how I'm using the term custom.
Right.
Not necessarily something that has to be done, but something that may be done.
Right.
Now, I've got a question relative to that. Did the Gentiles have such customs?
I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Yes, they did. Yes. And may they participate in those customs?
Well, when Paul talked about the marketplace when
All right.
he was in Athens,
All right.
he said, if you go down there and this guy says it was sacrificed to an idol, you may not do that.
All right.
But if there's no sign up that says this was sacrificed to so-and-so, you can buy all the meat you want.
That is right. So here is a custom that you may legitimately participate in. And I think that you've got a similar circumstance with the practices of the Jews. For example, as it pertained to the giving of the law of Moses, Here were meats that were unclean. Here were meats that were clean. Now we know from 1 Corinthians chapter 8, 9, and 10, and Romans 14, that meat is meat. Making a difference where it came from. There's no clean, there's no unclean. We know in 2 Timothy that God has cleansed all things. You can eat a rattlesnake if you want to, but you couldn't do it under the law of Moses. You can eat catfish if you want to, till your heart is content, but you couldn't do it under the law of Moses. Now, here's my question. If somebody wants to continue to observe those things as their culture or as a custom, may they do that? In other words, if I don't want to eat meats, I just want to be a vegetarian. Do I have to eat meats? Long as it don't bind it, yeah.
Right.
Long as it don't bind it. Can I do that?
Yeah.
Now, let's suppose that because I have a Jewish background that I've never eaten pork. Never eaten pork. And so I just don't want to eat pork. You can eat all pork you want to, but don't ask me to eat. I won't eat pork. And I look at that as a custom. Yes, it's associated with the law of Moses. It was forbidden under the law. It's called unclean. You can't do that. But my family are Jewish. And not really, for those. But let's just use that to illustrate the point. Okay, my family's Jewish. We never eaten pork. That's always been taboo. So I won't do that. Now, do I have that liberty?
Yes.
All right, I did. Yeah.
In studying this over the past week, I was just looking at other people to see what they have to say about this. And Stringer has an interesting comment in his commentary on the book of Acts, right toward the end of this discussion. I'd just like to read this paragraph real quick.
Okay.
He says, some have no problem with Jewish Christians circumcising their children or observing distinctions between clean and unclean meat. That's what we just talked about. But they accuse Paul of impropriety on this occasion because he participated in offering sacrifices. In other words, we're talking about contemporary now. Scripture, however, teaches Christians to follow Paul's example. Hence, if this were a case in which Paul acted wrongly, Scripture would indicate that his action was wrong, so that brethren would know that in this particular case, his example is not to be followed. Since this action was performed by one who is set before Christians as an example, we must conclude that it was right. And I think I agree with that.
Oh, I do too.
Paul is our example. If he did something wrong here, then it would have said so, much like in Galatians, the second chapter, when he chastised Peter.
Yeah.
Because he showed his prejudice, yeah, even though three times he had indicated.
That's right. So what we want to conclude, and I think he's correct, is that Paul did not participate in compromising activity at this point. He did not. And we're going to see that had been his former practice too. For we know that earlier he had himself taken a Jewish vow. Randy?
I think that the elders here in verse 20 are being a little bit tactful and generous to the Christians, saying that they're zealous for the law. Because you go back to Acts 15, as you pointed out, first of all, there in verse 1, the issue was, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, there's the word custom again, you cannot be saved. But down in verse 5, the party of the Pharisees rose up and said, it is necessary to circumcise them and to order them to keep the law of Moses.
Yeah. Now that's where they've overstepped their bounds.
They are absolutely saying, yeah, they can become Christians, but they're still going to keep that law of Moses.
Yeah. That's where they've overstepped their bounds.
And here in just a few years, I forget how far it is, less than 20, I think it is, God's going to make it to where the whole question's moot.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. And we're going to talk about that, time permitting. I want to get to that. We looked at this chart briefly last time, and I want to reiterate it because I think it's crucial. What Paul had taught. If Paul had taught that if you're going to practice circumcision, you're a debtor to keep the whole law, okay? He had taught that. He had rebuked Peter, as you pointed out, because of Peter's inconsistency. He had taught that. He had rebuked the Galatians because they had made distinctions between Jews and Gentiles. And he said, you're all children of God by faith in Christ. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ did put on Christ. We've got that. Galatians 3, verse 26 begin. The law he had taught was fulfilled. Virgil, you and I talked about that Tuesday or Thursday. How that when it's fulfilled, then it's no longer binding. You can't go back and pull bits and pieces of it and practice a little bit of it, such as the practice of circumcision. If you're going to bind that, you're going to have to bind all of it. Now, does that mean you can't practice circumcision? Oh, you can practice circumcision. You just can't practice it unto salvation. And that's what they were teaching. And Paul, in these passages, we've noted them, and I would urge you to go back and read them again. In Romans, the 14th chapter, a passage that has been so misapplied, and we've combated it so many times, reference to things that are not included in Romans 14, I think that we've perhaps even overdone it to the extent to conclude that there's nothing that fits in Romans 14. And that's foolishness, because it wouldn't be there if that were not the case. He's telling us in Romans 14 that here are some matters that are liberties. And he illustrates that in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, 9, and 10. And I would urge you to go back and read those three chapters. Chapter 8, 9, and 10. Because in that setting, we find that he's using similar illustrations to that which he used in Romans 14. And he makes a personal application in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Now, in reference to the specific illustrations that he uses in 1 Corinthians chapters 8 and 10, likewise in Romans 14, eating of meats. Let's suppose I'm a Jew, as we mentioned a while ago, and I've not been used to eating pigs, and I'm not going to do it now. Is that okay? Yeah, that's okay. I don't have to eat a pig. All right, I'm a Gentile. And I've been used to eating meats that's been sacrificed to this idol over here. And in my mind, if I do that, then somehow I'm giving homage to the idol. So I am not going to eat meat, period. Can I do that? Do I have to eat meat?
No.
No, that's a practice that I can engage in. And that sets the stage for these contexts. Romans 14 and 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10. Now, in chapter 9, I find it rather interesting, the illustration that Paul uses. He elaborates rather extensively on it. Just go back and look at it carefully. And he's talking about his own wages. His own wages. He establishes the point that he has the right to lead about a wife. Peter did. He said, I have the right to be supported. He said in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 14, that it is ordained that those who preach the gospel can do what? Live of the gospel. And he even offers the illustration that you don't put the muzzle on the ox. But what was Paul willing to practice? Is that something he must do? Must he be supported in the preaching of the gospel? No. But that is a liberty, like eating meats that have been sacrificed to idols. But in that particular instance, he chose not to exercise that liberty, lest somebody accuse him of just simply preaching for the wages. He received, however, wages from other churches, rather than to have that accusation lodged against him from those in Corinth. Now, two points that I want to follow that with. Paul had circumcised Timothy. We've read about that, 1 Corinthians 16, verse 3, and there was a reason for that. Was Paul keeping the law? No. Why did he circumcise Timothy? Pardon me? Keeping it from being a problem. Could it be said that Paul, in circumcising Timothy, was observing the practice or the custom of the Jews because of Timothy's heritage?
He said the custom of the Jews, not the law of Moses.
All right. That's what it said. That's what I meant. Could it be said that he circumcised Timothy to accommodate the custom of the Jews?
Yes.
Yeah? Now, down here, he refused to have Titus circumcised. Why? There was no custom of the Jew that had ever been binding upon the Gentile, and in particular, circumcision. Now, granted, you can pull from the law of Moses up here and say, well, that was a part of Timothy's heritage. Yes, but his father was a Greek. Did he have to circumcise Timothy? No. May he circumcise Timothy? Yes. Was he keeping the law of Moses when he circumcised Timothy? Was he binding the law of Moses when he circumcised him? Well, then, pray tell, why did he circumcise him? Because of his relationship with the Jews. That's right. Now, having said all that, I want to look at some other things. This I found rather interesting. It's just, you can put this together on your own, or you can go there and read it. I've modified it just a little bit to accomplish my purposes, but I wanted to give credit where credit's due. Paul himself had previously taken a Jewish vow, had he not? Where?
In Acts 18.
Yeah. Yeah, it's on there. Acts 18. Yeah, that wasn't what it meant. The name of the town is given in the text. All right.
Is this in Corinth?
No.
Centuria.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, later, we find in chapter 24 that he unashamedly, and I think that's an emphatic word, he unashamedly referred to this incident before Felix. It's what I did. It's okay. I did that. And then the action on Paul's part only confirmed one of the principles of his ministry, which was to become like a Jew to win Jews, and to become like one under the law to win those who were under the law. You remember the text, 1 Corinthians 9, to the Jew I became as a Jew. Did he become a Jew? No, he was a Jew as far as his heritage was concerned. But as far as their customs or practices were concerned, he behaved like they did. To those who were without law, what did he become?
Without
law. As without law. As without law. Now he said, not without law to Christ, so not in the absolute sense. But he came as the Gentile when he was working with the Gentile, became as the Jew when he was working with the Jew. Randy?
Is that indicated or illustrated by the fact that he didn't preach the gospel in Athens? He preached the God who you don't know.
Well, that's true. And of course, you've got application, different truths needed by different groups of people. These people didn't know God.
He wound up preaching the gospel in two verses.
Yes, he did.
I just mean, he didn't appeal to the scriptures.
No. Didn't know the scriptures. No, didn't know the scriptures. Now, let me illustrate this with just a down-home, maybe crude, oversimplification. Okay? When I lived in Arkansas, farm country, big farm country, I did not wear a three-piece suit when I went to the farms, to the fellas, to talk about the gospel or to visit with them. I dressed like they did, which I typically do anyway. But, be that as it may, dressed like they did. And a preacher acquaintance told me the story of an old preacher that was trying to teach a farmer who, many years before, plowed with a mule. And he said this preacher went to talk to this farmer, and the farmer was out in the field plowing, following the mule. He said the preacher just walked with him. Everywhere he went, he walked with him. Followed the mule. Talked with him about the gospel. Now, was the preacher a farmer? No. But did he become as a farmer? Yeah. Yeah. He did that. Now, why did he do that? That he might teach the farmer. You see, he's the teacher. But he didn't make himself separate and distinct from the farmer. He became as a farmer in order to teach them. Now, I know that's crude. That's oversimplified. But that's what we're seeing here. And I think that's just exactly what these elders are suggesting that Paul do. What these Jews who are Christians need to perceive from you is something that will take away their prejudice. That's what they need to see from you. You don't have to be compromised. And I appreciate Brother Stringer's comments there. You don't have to be compromised in order to do that. Now, where it compromises your efforts, can you do it? Can you do that? No. You see, here's a fellow that's an alcoholic. And I know every day when he gets off work, he goes to the bar and sits on the stool. And I want to teach him not to be an alcoholic, so I go to the bar and sit on the stool and order me a beer. Can I do that? Well, I mean, to the alcoholic, you become as the alcoholic, right? No, I can't engage in something I know is wrong. I can't do that. But I can follow the mule and walk beside the farmer because there's no sin involved in that, you see. I've not compromised a single solitary principle. Nothing. Now, Paul, in this engagement, what we've got to determine is, did Paul compromise his efforts to preach the gospel in this effort? Are these elders instructing him to do something that's going to compromise his efforts in preaching the gospel? Now, you're right on target when you say, if he did, then we would have later seen some evidence that you don't do what I do. But to the contrary, what did Paul say to those in Corinth? 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1. Be ye imitators of me, even as I also am of Christ. In Philippians 4, what did he say? You have me as
learned and seen and received it to me.
These things do. That's what you do. Now, when we look at what Paul's doing in this passage, there's a valuable lesson. There's things we need to learn. Now, another point that I left off up here is one of Paul's goals for this trip was what? To take the relief to the church in Jerusalem. That's what he's been circulating for up here in Asia and Macedonia and Achaia. And then number five, Paul was not denying the finished work of Christ by offering animal sacrifices. Now we want to note that too, because I think that becomes very important. The epistles of Paul have already made clear what he believes about the finished work of Christ. And so whatever sacrifice may have been offered was not to compromise his efforts. Now, we might discuss that point just a little more, but be that as it may, I want us to look at verse 1 of chapter 23 when Paul is making his next defense before the Jewish court. Now, that's significant because the Jewish court was not composed of Christians. In Acts 23, he's before the Jewish council, the Jewish court. So we're talking about those of the hierarchy of the Jewish religion in chapter 23. That's not his audience right here. Okay? And he says, I have lived before God in all good conscience until this day. Which tells us that the events of Acts chapter 21, he did not violate his conscience in practicing those things. Donna?
Was it Paul that appointed these elders?
No.
Or who had appointed these elders?
I don't know. No, don't know. This is the church in Jerusalem. We know they have elders, but we don't know who appointed them. Would likely be under the direction of the apostles, perhaps Peter, but that would be speculation because Peter's work was predominantly among those who were Jews. Pardon me? He has been with these elders before. Yes, in Acts 15. Yes, he has. And this has been the issue. So that it's recycled.
They didn't quite catch it the first time.
No. 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 Now, interestingly enough, we've said that this is the church in Jerusalem, like Acts 15. The difference being, this is the church in Jerusalem on the occasion of Pentecost, feast day. Okay? So we've got Jews not just residents of Jerusalem like we had in Acts 15, but we've got Jews that are from everywhere.
So the elders from everywhere?
No, these are elders of the church in Jerusalem. Yeah. Yeah. He's meeting with the elders of the church in Jerusalem. All right. Now, trouble with the Jews. Here's the problem. Here's what he's accused of. Randy and then Randy.
I'm sorry, but I'm still having a hard time getting by the offering of sacrifices.
Okay.
Verse 26.
Okay.
Paul took the man the next day, purifying himself along with him, went into the temple, giving notice of the completion of the days of purification until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them.
Okay.
So that's not animals?
Well, yes, I think so. When you go back into the text of Numbers chapter 6, I just urge you to go back and read that account because these were sacrifices not for sin, but sacrifices involved in the completion of a vow. Okay, Randy?
Yes, that's exactly. It helps if you understand at least the rudiments of the old law.
Yeah.
On this, that these were not, and it goes back to the point that you kind of said you were going to deal with in number five on the previous chart, that that yes, they were. You could give a sacrifice for any number of reasons.
Oh yes.
And just because you gave a sacrifice doesn't mean because you sinned. Sometimes you gave a sacrifice because God had really blessed you.
Yeah.
And you said, "Here, and so in that, and sometimes you gave one because you fulfilled a vow. So it wasn't for sin that these sacrifices were given. So it
right.
doesn't annul the death of Christ on
right. And there were all kinds of sacrifices. When it pertains to the specifics of the Nazarite vow, you'll notice that a part of that involved at the conclusion of the vow. Of course, part of the Nazarite vow was they didn't cut their hair. At the conclusion of the vow, what did they do? They shaved their head. What did they do with the hair? They burned it. All right, so is that a sacrifice? Yes. Yes. Was it an animal sacrifice? No. No, but it was a sacrifice.
Sometimes it was food sacrifice.
Yeah, so there's all kinds of sacrifices that we might be talking about. As far as animal sacrifices, I understand that it sometimes involved the sacrifice of doves or a pigeon or a ram or a lamb. Sometimes a basket of unleavened bread, a meat offering, sometimes a drink offering. There were a variety of sacrifices that were involved in some of these things. So they were not all, even Old Testament sacrifices, they were not all for sin. Okay, they had different objectives, different purposes served in that. All right, now, in regard to these accusations, I'm getting ahead of myself on the charts. Let me back up just a little bit. When you go back to verse 23, Acts 21, verse 23, he said, "Do therefore this that we say unto thee, we have four men that have a vow on them. Take these and purify thyself with them, and be at charges for them, that they may shave their heads, and all shall know that there is no truth in the thing whereof they have been informed concerning thee, but that thou thyself also walkest orderly, keeping the law." Now underscore that. What is it that Paul has been accused of? Teaching against the law. You've been accused of forsaking Moses and telling people not to circumcise their children, not to walk after their customs. Now, these people are zealous for the law. Now, what do we want them to see you do? We want them to see you walking orderly, keeping the law. Now, does that have any parameters? What's the... Pardon me?
It's not going to bind it.
All right. Well, I think it's a legitimate question. Does it have any parameters? Can one who is of a Jewish background keep the law? Well, we have to answer that in the affirmative. Yes. Now, does he keep the law in every respect? No. No, he cannot.
Depends on what you mean by keep.
That's exactly right.
If you're going to keep, if you're, for instance, going to offer a sacrifice, we'll say a drink offering, you have to do it the way God has specified it. In which case, when you do that, you're going to do it in the manner that God has prescribed.
All right, that's right. When we look at what these elders are suggesting, they are not at all suggesting you abandon the gospel, you abandon Christ, you go back and be a good Jew. They're not suggesting that at all. But they are suggesting that here are some things that contained and are addressed in the law of Moses that do not void or violate your relationship to Christ, and you may participate in those things to dispel these accusations. Okay? All right. Well, we'll hook on to that next time.